Acts 10 continued. The 38th talk in a series on the Book of Acts was presented by Jack Crabtree on January 30th, 2000 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2000. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. The following recording has a brief break in the middle. This is the result of the original 60-minute tape switching to the second side.
Smack dab in the middle of chapter 10 of the Book of Acts, and we looked last week at the account of Cornelius. We spent most of our time just kind of going through the story, so I want to briefly review it, and I emphasize briefly, and then I'd like to pick up on some points that I think we need to observe in this passage. As you will recall, Peter was in the smaller town of Joppa, probably a day or two journey from, it looks like it's about a two-day journey from Caesarea, which was the seaport for Jerusalem on the Mediterranean coast. And he's staying at a home of, he's being hosted there by Simon the Tanner in Joppa. In the meantime, up in Caesarea is a Roman centurion, a soldier, in charge of a whole cohort, who is a, what we call a God-fearer, a Gentile who has come to recognize the moral and spiritual superiority of the teachings of Judaism over the mystery religions and the paganism of the Roman Empire. He's become intrigued by that and is actually a student of the Jewish scriptures. He's not a convert. He has not proselytized to Judaism. He remains a Gentile, but he's a student of Judaism. Cornelius is visited by an angel, and the angel says to Cornelius, there's a man in Joppa, send for him, I want you to hear something from him. So he sends one of his attending soldiers and two servants to Joppa to fetch Peter. They bring him back. In the meantime, Cornelius has gathered a whole group of friends and relatives, and Peter comes to them and basically proclaims the gospel to them briefly. And a remarkable thing happens. Some of the same phenomenon that occurred on the day of Pentecost when the apostles and the 5,000 people gathered there. No, that wasn't 5,000. The people gathered in the upper room. Some of the same phenomena happened to Cornelius and his friends as happened to them. And that's where we broke off the story. The thing to keep in mind is that it's very possible that Peter has never in his life darkened the door of a Gentile, let alone failed to eat kosher, as he himself says in this story. So this is an incredible, dramatic break in his life to be able to get over the emotional resistance that would be required for him for the first time in his life to do something so bold, so audacious, so wrong, so evil, so unclean, as to attend to these servants and go back and speak to a group of Gentiles. And that's what we want to talk about a little bit today. I mentioned last week that Peter himself tells us what he learned in this event as he's speaking to Cornelius and his friends in chapter 10, verse 34 and 35. And opening his mouth, Peter said, I most certainly understand now that God is not one to show partiality, but in every nation the man who fears him and does what is right is welcome to him. I want to clarify a few things about what I said about that last week. There were a number of questions afterwards, and I want to respond to some of those questions. I mentioned that one Bible teacher that I was listening to talk about this verse makes a distinction between God welcoming this man who fears him and does what is right, as opposed to accepting him favorably, justifying him, his sins are forgiven, and so on. That there's a distinction between being saved and being welcomed by God. Evidently, I didn't make it clear I strongly disagree with that. I think what he's talking about here when he says he's welcome to him is that he's fully welcome in every sense of the word. I can't even make any sense out of the other, because what would Peter be saying? If we stop and think about the implications of what he would be saying, if he's making a distinction, he's not going to save you, but he's going to say, it's not that I don't like you, as he sends him to hell. I mean, in order for Peter to be saying anything significant and anything very at all meaningful, welcome him must mean welcome him. Welcome him must mean grant your favor to him. Otherwise, the distinction makes no sense to me. So I just want to be clear about that. Now, I need to recognize that in the day and age in which we live, where we are such a relativistic age, there is no such thing as absolute truth. There is no such thing as absolute right and wrong. In a day where we're being fed that garbage day in and day out all day long, it may sound like what I was saying last week is just one more form of that kind of relativism. It really doesn't make any difference what you believe as long as you're sincere, you know, as long as you are earnest or whatever. Don't be mistaken about that. I clearly reject cultural relativism. I do not believe truth is relative. Truth is objective. It's real. It is what it is, and anything that's opposed to that truth is simply false. It's wrong. Same thing is true with morality. Morality is objective. What is good is objectively good. What is wrong is objectively wrong. It doesn't make any difference who's doing the perceiving. If I call something that is objectively good, good, because it seems good to me, then I'm wrong, and I'm perverse, and I'm evil. I mean, that's clearly the biblical perspective here, and I'm not in any way challenging that perspective at all. So truth is not relative. The gospel of Jesus as the appointed king and the appointed high priest for every man, woman, and child throughout all of time, that Jesus is the one and only way to eternal life and is the one and only truth for every man and every woman who has ever lived. That's clear. The Bible couldn't be clearer about that. But the issue that I'm addressing is not whether Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life, as he says. The issue, rather, is this. What level of knowledge, what level of understanding, at what level of acceptance of Jesus and his unique role must I as a person have in order to demonstrate that I'm a child of God? That's the issue, and that's a different question. Jesus clearly is objectively the way, the truth, and the life. But to what extent do I have to have grasped that truth? How deeply, how profoundly, how comprehensively, how completely must I have grasped that in order to show that I am a child of God, destined for the kingdom of God? What I was arguing last week is, well, not completely. And actually, if you stop to think about it, if we really mean grasp it completely, then who of us is saved? I mean, aren't we on a journey? Aren't we on the way? Aren't we constantly learning? Aren't we constantly growing in our understanding of what the Bible is telling us about who this Jesus is? If we must completely and fully and exhaustively understand it, then none of us are qualified. Well, but how minimal an understanding can we have and still be a child of God? That's a more important question. Abraham, for me, is the paradigm for somebody who knows virtually nothing, but is nonetheless described as the father of our faith. You and I are following in the footsteps of our father Abraham, even though we know vastly more than Abraham ever hoped to know. He didn't know about Jesus. He didn't even know about Judaism. He wasn't even a Jew. He's the father of the Jewish people, but he wasn't a Jew, because that had not been the promises and the covenant that were made to Abraham were those promises that established the basis for Judaism, established the basis for the Jewish nation. All he knew is that this God who formerly he had not known came into his life, invaded his life, and started making promises to him. And it was to his credit that he recognized the power, the wisdom, the majesty, the reality of this God, and he believed his promises. That was to his credit. And that's the faith that you and I are called upon to emulate, to respond to the reality of the God who is really there and the truth of the promises that he's making to us. That's what faith is. Now, those promises that God made to Abraham over millennia got filled out and made more complete and were made more full and more detailed in what they were all about, how they were going to be worked out, what they all meant. Abraham was not privy to any of that further elucidation that occurred over the millennia by the prophets over time. So his understanding was not complete, but he was not at all deficient as a child of God. He was completely and utterly a child of God, more sanctified than you and I probably, but much, much less knowledgeable, much less hip to what the gospel is really actually saying. So what I'm suggesting is that what Peter learned is that the boundaries of who is acceptable to God and who is justified, who is saved, don't nicely correspond with the boundaries that he and his contemporary Jews had drawn. Peter and his contemporary Jews drew very reasonable and logical boundaries, given the level of understanding that God had given them. They were not just bigoted. They were not just irrationally ethnocentric in their viewpoints. They were trying to come to terms with what had been revealed to them, and they were trying to take it seriously, and they were trying to earnestly understand what God was up to in the world based on what the prophets had taught them. And their conclusions were not crazy. They were very understandable. They were very rational. But they were ultimately wrong. And what Peter is discovering here is that, in fact, they were wrong. And God is showing them more accurately, more thoroughly, what he's up to. What I was trying to suggest last week is that neither are our boundaries that we as Gentile Christians have drawn today, neither are they exactly right, at least not typically. And I think the reason is this, because acceptability to God is not based on the level of my knowledge or the level of my understanding or my acceptance of the truth. It's based on the condition of my heart relative to God. And hence, it's based on my receptivity to truth. And that's the distinction I'm making. It's based on my receptivity to truth, not on my actual full-blown acceptance of the truth. Why do I make the distinction? Because a lot of things can stand in the way of me accepting the truth, but only one thing can stand in the way of me being receptive to the truth. To not be receptive to the truth is to have what the New Testament would call a heart that is hard. To be in rebellion against God, to be in rebellion against the truth, to be stiff-arming God, to be stiff-arming his promises, stubbornly resisting it because I'm evil and because I'm unsanctified. But even if I have a heart that's open to God and receptive to the truth, there can be any number of sources of ignorance, of misunderstanding, of prejudice, of this or that, that stand in the way of me actually reaching out and embracing the truth that's there. Not embracing the truth because of one of these other factors does not damn me. What damns me is not accepting the truth because I don't want to follow the truth. I'm not even receptive to the truth. That's the claim I'm making. And if I'm right about that, if that's true, then that forces us to draw very different boundaries around those who are acceptable to God and those who are not. It used to be so easy for me. You accept Jesus as your Savior, you're in. You don't, you're out. That's easy. It's convenient. But it ain't true, if what I'm saying here is right. And I think that's what Peter is discovering. In every nation, the man who fears him and does righteousness is acceptable to him. Notice the description. This is not describing the level of a person's understanding. It's describing the condition of their heart. The man who fears God, I would submit, is a condition of the heart. And does righteousness, I would submit, is an inner reality of what Jesus called hungering and thirsting after righteousness. These are moral and spiritual conditions of the inner being, not outward acts of accepting this or that truth. And Peter has discovered that that's the man who is acceptable to God. Okay, the questions that came up last week then, are you saying that you don't have to be a Christian to be saved? Well, let me answer it this way. No one can be saved who is not in principle receptive to the truth that Jesus is the Messiah. And indeed, I'd go even further than that. No one can be saved who is not in principle receptive to the entire truth of God as revealed by the apostles. Furthermore, I would say that no one can be saved who does not ultimately know, understand, and enthusiastically embrace the truth that Jesus is the Messiah. If we never embrace that truth, ultimately, then of course we're not children of God. How are we going to exist in the kingdom of God with Jesus the King as King and deny his kingship? It can't be done. Ultimately, we are all going there if we are children of God. Ultimately, we will believe that truth. We must believe that truth. We can't fail to believe that truth. It's the objective reality that all of us are more closely approximating as we grow in our wisdom. So ultimately, of course, we have to embrace that truth. So in other words, if to be a Christian is to proclaim Jesus the Messiah, then no one can be saved who does not ultimately embrace Christianity, who does not ultimately become a Christian. However, notice how I am defining Christianity, to proclaim Jesus the Messiah. But we must clearly and without confusion confess confess that Jesus is the Messiah right now, today, in order to be saved today? What I'm saying is not necessarily. If our failure to confess Jesus as the Messiah is not a function of our lack of receptivity to the truth, and is rather a function of some other factor, then we could, in principle, today, be a sanctified child of God without believing in Jesus today. Look at Cornelius for a second. Cornelius was a child of God before he sent his servants to Joppa, wasn't he? By my old paradigm, however, I would have answered it the other way. By my old paradigm, I would have said, look at this neat thing that God is doing in Cornelius' life. He's sending an angel to have him go get Peter so that Peter can come to him so that he can become a child of God, that he can become a disciple of Jesus, that is to say, a child of God. But that's not the way Peter's interpreting it. Peter's not interpreting it that Cornelius is now becoming a child of God in that room where they begin to speak in other languages. He already was a child of God. He was a man who feared God and who did what was right. He did righteousness. And such a man is already acceptable to God. On the other hand, if our failure to confess Jesus as the Messiah today is indeed a function of our lack of receptivity to that truth, then we are not saved today. We have not been born again. For the one who has been born again is, by virtue of that being born again, is receptive to and drawn to the truth. So, can we not confess Jesus the Messiah today and be saved? Well, it depends. It depends on why we don't believe that Jesus is the Messiah. Okay, the next question is, if all this is true, then what's the point of sharing the gospel? If we don't need to understand and accept Jesus as the Messiah to be saved, then why evangelize? Why be missionaries? Why any of this stuff? Well, I ask the question, why did Peter go to Cornelius? Why did God send Peter to Cornelius? To save him? No, not if I'm interpreting this right. Rather, it was to impart a fuller and more complete understanding of the truth to him. We share the gospel, we go out as missionaries, we evangelize for the same reason. To take to those people who are being called to be children of God that more complete and fuller wisdom that is the destiny of all of us who are the children of God. And we are taking that to them. I think what we don't understand, what we don't really appreciate, is that this life as disciples of Jesus is not only about, or even primarily about, getting saved. If what we mean by that is getting some kind of entry into the kingdom of God. This is about getting wisdom, which is the substance of the kingdom of God. The other is just a form without any substance. I mean, the Bible doesn't even know the category of getting saved without getting wise. It doesn't even recognize that as a category. We have to become wise in order to manifest that God is at work within us. If you don't get wise, you don't get saved. And if you are being saved, you are being made wise. And God will go to the ends of the earth to make possible that you become wise. God will wipe out your whole life around you in order that you might become wise. God loves you so much that he terrorizes you in order that you might become wise. That's the trials, the tests, the tribulations that we all go through. The Bible sees those as the loving hand of God, like the angel sent to Cornelius to go fetch Peter. It's the finger of God in our lives at work to make sure that we get it, that we understand, that we grow, that we become wise and receptive people who are drawn to the truth. We miss that priority, and we think the whole point of all of this is just to get people to that one outward act of believing in Jesus, as if you got there and you're done, and there's nothing more, and there's nothing of any substance beyond that. The Bible takes the other point of view. To accept Jesus is just one manifestation of a much bigger reality that's going on, and that bigger reality is the living God at work through life and experiences and circumstances to bring us to a real love of God, a real fear of God, a real hunger and thirst for righteousness, a real person of wisdom and integrity who will be that substantive creature for all of time. That's his project. And why, if I were a child of God, would I want someone to come and tell me the gospel that I didn't know? Because if I don't hear the gospel, I don't know what God's up to. And what could be more valuable in life? What is the longing of our heart? What is the desire of our heart as children of God, except to know what life is all about? What are you up to, God? What is this all for? Where is this going? And how do I fit into this? To know that is a precious, precious thing. Well worth taking to people. We don't need any more motivation to evangelize than that, I would argue. Okay, that was last week. I want to ask a few more questions about chapter 10 here this week. First of all, briefly, what's the significance of this event? This is the first time, as I would assess the evidence here, this is the first time that the nature of the gospel as extending the same promises of life in the eternal kingdom of God to Gentiles as well as to Jews is fully understood and squarely faced by the early Jewish disciples. And that's ironic. I mean, in a sense, Paul is the apostle that Jesus is appointing to take the gospel to the Gentiles, but Peter is the one who is first confronted with this truth. An irony there. We're going to see in a few chapters that this event and the implications of this event end up leading to a systematic effort on the part of these early Jewish disciples to take the gospel to the Gentiles. And again, even before Paul steps into that project of evangelizing the Gentiles a little bit late in the game. Well, I mean, not late in the game, but he's not the pioneer. It has already been pioneered, but then when he does step in, he takes on this project with a vengeance, and he becomes the primary evangelist to the Gentiles. Okay, that's the significance of this event. But I think to really fully understand this event, we have to understand as well its paradigm-busting nature. This thing that Peter learned is not just a simple addition to his worldview. It's not just a simple, and this is true also. This thing that he's learning is requiring that he take his whole old paradigm of who God is and what God is up to in the world, dismantle it, and build it up all over again. And I think it's worth spending some time looking at the paradigm-busting nature of what Peter is going through here, because if you're like me, you have had one or more such experiences in your life. and maybe having such an experience now. Because part of the growth process is to constantly have our paradigms exploded only and completely dismantled only to rebuild them again. This is it. The inclusion of the Gentiles in the blessings of Abraham is a very radical and revolutionary idea to Peter and to all his contemporaries. It's just a whole different way of thinking about how God is supposed to be working in the world. As such, we can expect that his reaction when these men stand outside of Simon Tanner's house and call for Peter, and he comes down to them and surprisingly, I mean, in an act of courage and an audacious, bold step, invites them in to even hear what they want. He's already going against his xenophobia. I want to talk about xenophobia a little bit here. What do I mean by xenophobia? Xenophobia comes from two words, xenos in Greek, which means stranger, and phobia, of course, means fear. It's the fear of strangers. And typically we think of xenophobia as at the root of racism and nationalism, any kind of ethnocentrism where my people are the good guys and everybody else is strange, is weird. And it can lead to a hatred, a hostility, an enmity, an antagonism toward other groups. Typically that's the way we think of it. I'm going to expand the definition a little bit to simply be a fear of what is unfamiliar, a fear of what is strange altogether. And in that sense, Peter undoubtedly would have had a xenophobic reaction to inviting these men into his home and later going up and entering a Gentile's home and proclaiming the gospel to the Gentiles. He undoubtedly would have had a xenophobic reaction. And I want to talk about that a little bit because any of us who read the newspaper at all are very aware, very well aware that there's only one virtue in the world today. The virtue is tolerance of diversity. And there's really only one vice in the world today, and that's xenophobia. We usually speak of homophobia rather than xenophobia, but homophobia is just a specific form of xenophobia. But racism, homophobia, ethnocentricity, all of those things, it's the only real evil left in the world. If we can just stamp that evil out, then we will be enlightened and pure. That's more or less the attitude of the modern age. I want to give a little up with xenophobia message here. A xenophobic reaction, I would argue, is not inherently evil. It is a God-given reaction, created by God, much like our pain reflex, much like the impulse of pain. It's a protective device. It's something that God created to protect us. To have a xenophobic reaction is not in and of itself to be unenlightened. I would liken a xenophobic reaction to, some of you may have computers that you're going to think I'm pretty silly having a dinosaur or a computer, but whenever I want to erase a disk, my computer puts a little dialog box on the screen that says, "Are you sure you want to erase this disk?" It's all I can do to say, "Okay." Why? Is there something wrong with that? I mean, am I not supposed to erase my disk? Or what? Obviously, the purpose of that dialog box is to ask you to stop and think about what you're doing. Think about the consequences of what you're doing before you're doing it. It's not really trying to scold you. It's really not trying to suggest that there's something inherently wrong with what you're doing, but you better stop and think about it because there are some significant consequences to this, and you want to do this thoughtfully. You want to make a judgment as to whether you want to do this. Don't just knee-jerk erase your disks. And that's what it's trying to do. Xenophobic reaction, I would argue, is that dialogue box in us. When something comes along that is strange and unfamiliar and is not a part of my life, is not a part of my lifestyle, is not a part of the world that I live in, this little dialogue box comes up that says, now, Don't just accept it. Ask some questions. Think about it. Decide whether this is right and good or whether this is wrong. But don't just accept it. Stop and think about this first. Our xenophobic reaction, I would argue, serves us quite well. I mean, imagine encountering cannibalism for the first time. I mean, how are we going to respond? Oh, cool. I didn't know you could eat people. Hey, far out. What a great idea. Instead, we have we're repulsed by it. We get a very intense, visceral, physical, psychological, emotional reaction of abhorrence. Can a human being get over that? Jeffrey Dahmer's did. Is he the epitome of enlightenment? I don't think so. I mean, we can get over our visceral reaction in time. We can condition ourselves. We can train ourselves to not have that reaction. But to do away with that reaction is not enlightenment. To do away with that reaction is just stupid. The question of enlightenment and wisdom is, what do you do with the reaction? The right thing to do with the reaction is exactly the same thing we do with that dialogue box. We stop and think, and we decide, yes, I want the disc erased, and we click OK. Or we go, oh, that's 10 years worth of data that I don't want to lose. No, I don't want to do that. But we have stopped and made an intellectual, and in the case of our xenophobic reaction, moral judgment, rather than just respond and react. Now, it's true, there are some of us, and I have been there in my life, there are some of us who never get past the xenophobic reaction to the judgment part. We simply stay there at the visceral level. It's abhorrent to me, I reject it. It feels abhorrent, I reject it. It feels strange, I reject it. It feels different, it's not true. And that, of course, is the truth that modern society is exploiting to try to get us to go way beyond that. The truth that's there is that a mature, enlightened, wise individual is not going to judge everything strange as wrong. Of course not. All kinds of things that are unfamiliar to me are nonetheless right and acceptable. And furthermore, I'm not going to stay with that reaction as a reaction and act out of that reaction. I'm going to act out of further judgment. Let's take homophobia, for example. My xenophobic reaction to homosexuality is God-given and natural and appropriate. But what do I do with that? Well, as a biblical Christian, it seems to me, I need to ask the question, okay, now wait a minute, do I have this right? Is this just a different option that God has created in the world, or is it actually wrong? What does the Bible say? And I analyze it, and I think about it, and I come to some conclusions. Some sober, serious, intelligent, open-minded conclusions about what the Bible is actually teaching. I believe that such a conclusion is that homosexuality is wrong, that it's a perversion of what God had in mind. Having come to that conclusion now, what do I do with that? The Bible has some other things to say to me. It says, Jack, you're just as perverse as the next person. Jack, you're just as broken as the next person. No matter how your brokenness might manifest itself, you're no different. And what do we want for people like you, Jack? Mercy. We want mercy. We want mercy. And mercy is appropriate because God is a God of mercy. So we want God's mercy to be shown to all the homosexuals in the world who have chosen a different lifestyle from you. We want forgiveness. Your responsibility, Jack, is to love your neighbor, not just some of your neighbors, all of your neighbors, Jack. Your responsibility is to love them. So I can come to a sober and sound judgment about what is the right and proper perspective to take toward what is going on in the world around me. I don't just react viscerally with some kind of hatred and antagonism toward what's different. I mean, I'm tempted to, but that there's nothing wise about that. There's nothing right about that. But the reaction itself is not wrong. The reaction itself was simply getting my attention and saying, you got to do some thinking here now, Jack. You run into something that confronts you with a whole world that's different from your world, and I guess you're going to have to sort out what part of it is true and what part of it is false, and you're going to have to accept what's true and reject what's false. But in rejecting what's false, don't just respond viscerally. Respond morally and intelligently. Respond as you ought to respond. Well, back to Peter. Peter undoubtedly had a xenophobic reaction. I know exactly how he felt. I remember the first time I walked into a Catholic church, I just got this incredible, creepy, uneasy feeling. I mean, understand, I was raised a Protestant, and to be a Protestant meant you weren't a Catholic. I just thought, I felt like I was going into a temple of Zeus or something, that it was just such a bizarre feeling. Peter is experiencing something like that. Undoubtedly, he has to be. He has spent his whole childhood and most of his adult life with the notion that the Gentiles are unclean. They are dogs. They are rejected by God. They can't be acceptable to God because they are outside his covenant. And that's not an irrational conclusion of the Jews to reach. I want to emphasize that. We Gentiles get pretty cocky because we haven't read our Old Testament. We're so ignorant of our Old Testament that we look at the Jews of this time and think, boy, how stupid. Boy, did they really get it wrong. The truth of the matter is, it's very understandable why they would have reached the conclusions that they reached, given the level of revelation that had been given to them up to that point. What we forget is that Jesus was the last prophet. Jesus was the one who came and put the last pieces together in the puzzle to make sense out of everything that had gone before. And when we have the last pieces, then it all falls in place, and we understand what really the promise to Abraham was, and what really the promise made to Israel in the time of Moses was. When we can get some perspective on that, then we understand what God was saying all along. But without the last piece, the picture looks very different. It comes as a surprise. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, I think that's why Paul calls it a mystery hidden from past generations when he's referring to the gospel. He understands that there's a secret in it. There's a secret that nobody could know, really. I mean, not that they couldn't know, but it's not likely that they would know without the last piece being put in place. So Judaism had earnestly tried to put the picture together in a particular way. They got it wrong because they were missing a few pieces. So they believed that their lifestyle, their choices, their attitudes, their reactions to the Gentiles and everything was ordained by God, was in line with the objective truth of who God was and what he was up to in the world. Well, that's powerful. When you think your perspective is not just yours, but yours because of the living God, that you have a strong incentive to be loyal to it and to embrace it and to hold to it and hang in there with it and not deviate from that. Well, that's where Peter's coming from. And then all of a sudden, he has this vision as he's on the... I guess I forgot to review that part. He has this vision as he's up on the roof. God telling him to not eat, to eat some things that are not kosher. Peter says, I've never eaten anything unclean, God. God says, eat. And he's puzzling over that when these men come from Cornelius. There must have been a voice inside of him. His head must have been pounding. If he's anything like me, his head was pounding as he welcomed these servants into the house. A voice was screaming at him inside, you unclean, heretical, disloyal, God-hating... You fill in the note. I don't know. And yet, somehow, he finds the strength to do it anyway against all of that inward pressure, telling him, you're a heretic, you're disloyal, you're a fool to do this. We have to admire and respect and ultimately we need to emulate the courage that Peter is showing here. When I must have been 11 or 12, something like that, And we lived in Klamath Falls, and I used to walk down to my older brother and babysit for him. And I greatly admired my older brother. I very much respected him. I was babysitting one day, and I had gone to get a book, or I don't remember what, but I discovered his pipe and came to the realization that he smokes a pipe. Well, from where I was coming from, it's impossible to smoke tobacco through any instrumentation, through any vehicle, through any delivery system. If you can't smoke tobacco and be a child of God, be a believer. I was devastated. I was absolutely, completely wiped out. Everything felt shaky. The whole world that I was standing on seemed to be unraveling before me. How can I both respect him and come to the judgment that my brother's not a child of God? This man who claims to be one, who knows so much, who's so knowledgeable, how can both be true? And very often, the way our paradigms get busted is by God putting us in an untenable position where we don't want to go either direction. We want to follow the truth. In this case, I wanted to respect my brother. I couldn't not respect my brother on the one hand, and yet to respect my brother required that I give up on my paradigm. And of course, we cherish our paradigms. We don't want to give up on them. So I was on the horns of a dilemma here. And typically, that's what God does to us. He puts us in a position where we can't win either way. We're going to lose either way, in hopes that we'll let go of our paradigm and be willing to let him build a new one for us. When I was in California, a pastor in California, I did quite a few weddings, and there was one man who had a real serious struggle, because he had grown up all of his life believing that in sexuality you were supposed to save yourself for marriage, that you wouldn't be sexually active before marriage, and so that you would get married a virgin, and you would marry a virgin and live happily ever after. The problem was, the woman that he was engaged to was not a virgin. Everything in his soul, all the self-righteousness that was deeply embedded there, but not just self-righteousness, it was deeper than self-righteousness. It was his whole paradigm, his whole world, his whole concept of what was good and right and true told him that this woman was unclean, on the one hand. On the other hand, he loved this woman deeply and could not imagine letting her go. I mean, couldn't imagine deciding not to marry her. It was very interesting to see, as difficult and as agonizing a process as it was, to finally be able to resolve that by rethinking his whole paradigm of what does it mean to be clean? What does it mean to be righteous? What does it mean to be pure? What does it mean to be virginal, even? All that had to be replaced. All that had to be transformed. All that had to be rethought. It was a difficult process, but it was probably the most important lesson he ever learned in his life. That's a paradigm-busting experience. And notice again, just as it is with me, the horns of the dilemma. God cleverly, like a master chess player, putting us in a position where we're going to have to give up something we want, or we're going to have to give up something that we want. And which is it going to be? It's his tenderness, it's his kindness, it's his compassion that he puts us in that position, as he leads us to give up our paradigms, the thing that we want very much but shouldn't want. We have to give that up. Peter is being put in a position here to give up his paradigm, and it's to his credit, to his maturity, to his wisdom, that he's willing to do so. But his head must have been pounding. I'll give you one other example. I'm not going to finish today either. one other example, and then I'll just stop and leave room time for you. I don't really know where this came from, but as I grew up in the Christian culture that I grew up, the church culture I grew up in, I had this incredible aversion to alcohol. Alcohol was the ultimate evil, I think. I remember two nightmares in my entire life, and one of them was being chased down the street and being tackled by a bunch of thugs who pinned down my arms and legs and took an eyedropper with alcohol in it, pried my mouth open, and put a drop of alcohol in my tongue. And as the drop of alcohol would hit my tongue, there was this incredible sense of defilement that would come over my whole body, and then I wake up. I didn't like alcohol. So I went away to college, and I came under the teaching of a Bible teacher that I greatly respected. And over the course of time, issues, lifestyle issues came up, and I had to rethink intellectually. Intellectually, I had to rethink: was alcohol inherently evil, or was it just the abuse of alcohol that was evil? And I finally became persuaded that it was actually the abuse of alcohol that was wrong. Alcohol in and of itself was not inherently evil. So when I saw my Bible teacher take a glass of wine once, that was a problem. That was difficult. I had that xenophobic reaction on the one hand. On the other hand, I had become persuaded and I was okay with it. But I was really tested one day when I was a sophomore in college, and it was in a History of Western Civilization class, and my TA invited me to dinner. So I went to dinner, and he knew from our discussion in class, he knew that I was a Christian. And at that point, I was very intent on being a good witness, having a good testimony for Jesus. So he's in the kitchen making dinner, and he yells out to me, "Can I get you a glass of sherry?" I said, as politely and as non-condemningly as I could, "No, thank you." Only about 30 seconds later, he shows up in front of me, and I won't get his body language yet, but his body language was just spoke volumes. He was kind of, "Here." And I just, you know, I knew what he was saying is, "Are you going to be one of those kinds of Christians?" So, I was in the horns of a dilemma here. On the one hand, I didn't want any sherry at all. I wasn't at all interested, on the one hand. On the other hand, I wanted to be a good witness. And I was convinced in my own mind that not drinking did not make you a Christian, that was not the essence of Christianity, is that come to Jesus and don't drink, was not what this was all about. And I didn't want to send that message to him. I wanted him to recognize that there was some freedom in Jesus and that was not the whole point. So I accepted it. For those of you who want to start drinking, don't start with sherry. but it wasn't the sherry. It was literally, I thought my head was going to explode with this voice inside saying, "You evil, sinful, awful person, you awful human being. Don't you dare do this." But I was able to just say, "Jack, shut up." And it went away. As I realized, regardless of what my insides are saying to me, regardless of what my xenophobic response is, the truth is you are free. And believe the truth and go with that. Don't listen to the other voices. That I'm convinced is what Peter would have had to have done here. And in fact, it is what he did here. Notice in that regard, then, how he describes it. And then I'll stop with that. He says, in verse 28 of chapter 10, this is the first thing he says to Cornelius when he enters the room. He said to them, "You yourselves know how unlawful it is for a man who is a Jew to associate with a foreigner or to visit him." I mean, that's such tame language. I don't think we can feel the emotions that have to be behind that. I mean, you yourselves know how unlawful, what he's saying is, you yourselves know how incredibly inappropriate what I'm doing is here. I am doing something that no Jew is going to do. But, he says, and yet, God has shown me that I should not call any man unholy or unclean. Even though every fiber of my being tells me that I am stepping into the pit of uncleanness here by talking to you guys, nonetheless, God has shown me that the truth is other than that. So never mind how I feel about this, I'm going to act on what God has shown me is true. Maybe we'll take some time to develop this more next week, but I can't emphasize enough how important it is that as children of God, we not be ruled by our xenophobic reactions, we not be ruled by our old paradigm, we not be ruled by the emotional constraints that my allegiance and loyalty to an old paradigm imposes on me. I know that they are strong. I have lived there. I have been there. I know how hard it is emotionally and psychologically to repent of one paradigm and accept another one. But the mark of a child of God is the willingness to pursue the truth, whatever it is and wherever it leads. Whatever it is and wherever it leads. And that the courage to do that is the mark that we are truly children of God. We'll talk more about that next week. But your comments and questions.
If someone offered you a glass of sherry today in the same way that that person offered you a glass of sherry back then, what would you do today?
I'd probably take it if it was in the same way and if the same issues. If I were to be sending the message to them that I thought was a misrepresentation of what Christianity was all about, I would probably accept it today. And I should say, to this day, I don't drink as a lifestyle. It's just not part of my...
It seems that this person had a paradigm that was inaccurate.
Yes.
And...
The person with the offering the sherry, yeah.
Yes. And in fact was, instead of asking himself the question, is what I really think true? Instead of questioning his own paradigm, he, in a sense, forced you to... He put the onus on you rather than really on himself. And that's what was evil. And so perhaps part of your reaction to him was appropriate. It wasn't just about the sherry.
Well, yeah, that's true, but I don't think so. I mean, whatever reaction was there was crowded out by this other reaction. I mean, clearly the dominant reaction is, Jack, what about the choice you're making here? You coward. I mean, see, my old paradigm would have said, I have to have the courage to stand by my convictions. I have to have the courage to stand up for Jesus, to be loyal to Jesus here. And Jesus would have you reject the sherry. You're being a coward here to accept this. And I basically had to say, shut up, Jack. That's not what's going on here at all. You know, there might have been that other piece of it as well, but it got drowned out by my own paradigm busting experience.
First, I want to ask a question and then give a situation that happened and see if it's accurate. When we're faced with this new paradigm change or this stranger anxiety or fear, would you agree that it takes a matter of time, a moment, to make that transition or make that change in our thoughts or allow God to have a moment in time?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. This is what seems so sad to me in our society right now, especially for our younger people, that there's no time anymore. And the best example I can come to myself with, Friday I went to Thurston High School for this help program that I do at the high schools and with two other physicians, and we split the boys and girls up, and we're all believers and we keep it very, very safe. And we don't talk about anything that's not appropriate for any child in the class or for any parent.
Appropriate sexually or spiritually?
Hopefully both. But we talk about breast self-exam and
okay.
you know, we keep it split with boys and girls. But what happened at Thurston is that the teacher thought a police officer was coming to talk about something else, and we came, and there was a mix-up. So she didn't have time to get the class ready for the change. And we walked in, we got our stuff set up, and it was all girls. And this one young little Indian gal was thrown. She probably would not have been allowed to be a part of this class. But she got thrown off because she didn't have time. So what she did, it was so fascinating, is she put her backpack up on the table in front of her face and hid behind it. And as we spoke, she began to realize that it was going to be safe for her. So her eyes first poked up, and then eventually the backpack came off the table. But what I came away with, and especially after hearing you today, is that most times we don't have courage to put the backpack up until we know it's okay, especially our young people. They have to make instant decisions. Society doesn't give them a chance to put the backpack up because they would be laughed at or scorned. And it took a lot of courage for her to do that. And so what you were, I mean, it meant so much to me to hear you say that all of us have to be willing to have time, to give ourselves a little bit of time to make that decision. Is that, would you agree with
yes,
that?
Yes, I would. I would. Because the whole point of our reaction is to say, take the time. Don't rush into this here. Evaluate the situation. Assess it. Discern morally the good from the bad and only embrace the good. And that, obviously, that's a process that is going to take some time. And yeah, exactly. We do need to take the time. Can I hitchhike on that a little bit, too? Notice what happens in our society, like in the sexual education in the schools and so on. One of their goals, it seems to me, is to strip our kids of their modesty. They understand a feature of human experience, and that is, if you become familiarized with something, then you will stop having a xenophobic reaction to it. But that's to short-circuit the whole process. I mean, if I lived with cannibals, I could learn to not be abhorred by cannibalism too. But do I want that? The underlying assumption in our society is we want to accept anything and everything. Obviously, we're selective, and at this point in time, we're not ready for cannibalism yet. But in principle, our society has no reason to reject cannibalism. I mean, you hear the anthropologists of the university, and they'll say flat out, "Hey, you know, it's just a different way of living." Some of them will. And so, what we do is we don't use our xenophobic reaction to stop and ask, "Now, let's evaluate morally and rationally here," but rather, a xenophobic reaction is simply something to get over. Well, how can you get over it? Well, you don't want to stop and think about it, because if you stop and think about it, you might actually decide that there's something morally objectionable on the other end of your reaction. So let's not stop and think about it. Let's just batter you and inundate you with situations and ideas and so on, so that you lose your reaction. The shock value of this foreign thing, this strange thing, no longer has an impact on you, and then you'll accept it, and then you won't respond to it any longer. Well, that's a terrible thing for a society to do to itself, because there are no limits to what we will ultimately accept if we can get over our xenophobic reactions. Margaret?
It seems like when that fellow offered you the glass of wine, there could have been at least two things going on there. One is, he knows accurately that there's no moral problem with ingesting alcohol. And he wants to see, he thinks that's such a basic, commonsensical understanding. He wants to see if you share that understanding, because if you don't, he's not going to consider anything else you have to say. If you're wrong about this, there's no chance in hell that you're right about anything else. And that seems to be the way you interpreted it.
Mm-hmm.
It's also possible that what he was trying to do was seduce you into betraying your values, and to see if he could do that. And I've been in both positions where I thought both were going on, not simultaneously, but situations where I was being tested to see, do I have a firm grasp on the obvious, in which case they're willing to listen to something else that I have to say, or can I get you to compromise your principles, in which case I feel sort of delighted in the power that I have over you. And we kind of see that happen in Scripture also, when it talks about the weaker brother, stronger brother, not eating meat sacrificed to idols, in a situation where you can't make it clear why you're doing what you're doing, lest the weaker brother observe your freedom and conclude, oh, I guess righteousness doesn't matter. So it seems like in any particular situation like that, you've got to, in order to make the correct decision on how to behave, you've got to understand what's going on in the observer's mind. And sometimes that's hard to do. I know that one of your favorite movies is Chariots of Fire, and one of the things that you like about it is Eric Little's refusal to compete on the Sabbath, even though I know you disagree with his theology. In that he was sort of in the equivalent situation that you were in, except for that he genuinely believed to do such a thing on the Sabbath. What was great about what he did was that he stood up for his principles. If he had caved in, it would have been an entirely different thing than what you did by accepting that glass of wine.
Right.
He would have been being corrupted.
Right.
The flip side of this, you know, my acting and other people observing, is when I find myself on the horns of this dilemma and I feel drawn to both horns and I've got to pick one, you know, hopefully we come to the right conclusion, but there is the dynamic of all of us hate to be rejected, all of us want to be accepted. It could very well be that you let your love for your brother triumph over the truth that tobacco is inherently evil. And that's one thing that scares me to death. When I feel that tug, if I hadn't thought about homosexuality as long as I had and wrestled with it, my colleague, who you've probably heard me talk about several times, I really like her. I'm very fond of her. And I'm not about to confess that I'm attracted to her. That's not what I'm about to say. But I've seen the pain that she experiences by rejection. And there's a part of me that wants not to be part of that pain, that wants to say, I accept you utterly, completely. I do not reject anything about you. And I can feel that tug too. And so I guess I think there's a flip side to this. When God sticks you in this dilemma, it's terrifying when you don't know where the truth is.
Mm-hmm.
And you recognize your own capacity to respond not only to the truth, but also to respond to the desire to be accepted, that kind of thing. I was just wondering if you'd ever been in a situation where you felt tugged by the very human desire to be loved and accepted, and whereas, I think you know what I'm asking,
mm-hmm.
and how I want to change my mind if what I believe is wrong. I don't want to change my mind if what I want is acceptance.
Right. Yeah, that's right. I can't think of any real dramatic examples in my life. There are, you know, I have memories of less dramatic examples. And more often than not, I failed. I punted to my discredit, to my shame, I should have really kind of held my guns, and instead I kind of caved in a dialogue, in a conversation, where the appropriate thing to say was X. And I said, I mumbled something that could easily be interpreted as not X. Right, I just think that was a huge mistake. I think that was a failure of courage and a failure of wisdom on my part.
And you're right. The worst situation is to be on the horns of that dilemma and not know the truth. That's very, very difficult to try to navigate that. And that was really the case with my brother and the pipe. I didn't know the truth at that point. I didn't resolve that at the time. It wasn't until years later that I could finally resolve that whole issue. It was just agonizing. It was just traumatic to me without really being immediately productive in that case. And sometimes that's what's going to happen, is we're going to go through an experience like that that's traumatizing, not immediately productive, but over the course of time, it's one of those things that's been logged away that I have to understand and will in time understand and be able to resolve. Let's have one more, and then we're over time, so I need to let you go. But
I guess this is more of a comment than anything else. As you were talking, you talked a lot about your internal struggles and paradigm shifts and all that kind of stuff. And one thing that crossed my mind that was very profound and significant on Peter's part is the willingness to go against social pressures.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, everybody had to have known that those men were waiting at that door for him, and then for him to invite them in. And then everybody had to have seen him go over to Cornelius's house. The phenomenal pressure may have even been greater there than the internal struggle to have it known by everybody. And regarding what Margaret just said, I mean, he's a good example of punting. I mean, in Galatians, he punted.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was a pretty profound time when he knew it was right, and he did the thing that was wrong anyway.
Right, good point.
So,
good. Okay, thanks. I need to let you go.